Hey everyone, welcome to Tech Can't Save Us, podcast by Literal Humans. I'm Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans, and I'm here today with Tiernan Mines of Hello Lamppost. Tiernan, welcome.
Hey Paul, yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be on.
Yeah, really, really excited to have you on. So first things first, we got connected through a mutual friend because we kind of live in this tech for good ecosystem. Like tell the audience how we got connected real quick and yeah, a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, surprisingly small space, I guess, world tech for good, especially in London. Yeah, I think you are applying for a couple of different programs, right, to do with tech for good, which we've been through a couple of those programs in the past. Yeah, so we went through Facebook's tech for good program and Microsoft's AI for good program in London. A little bit about myself. Yeah, grew up not far outside of where I am right now in London. Started life off in real estate, and then a long meandering journey into the kind of tech for good entrepreneurial space. Ran a couple of ventures and joined a couple of startups before Hello Lamppost, and then launched Hello Lamppost in 2018 with my two co-founders.
Nice. And what were you doing in real estate? Give us that background real quick.
So yeah, I probably one of the many people who went to university not really knowing what to do, and yeah, did a degree in real estate and surveying, and then kind of decided that, you know, I wasn't going to restart my course, but actually just used the parts that I enjoyed. Joined Tesco on one of their grad schemes, which was awesome. So started off in their property arm, kind of managing their estate basically, and then moved into the kind of UK business strategy team for Tesco UK, which was kind of far more overarching view, as you can imagine. And we were kind of working on a number of kind of secret squirrel projects, but stuff like, you know, click and collect when that was, you know, a fresh idea. And then, yeah, left there. That was kind of the end of my real estate career.
Do you think it helped you having Tesco on your CV?
Yeah, no, yeah, I'd imagine so. I mean, great company to work for, especially their grad scheme is so well structured and so well varied. But yeah, no doubt, you know, massive company. I think at one point they were like the second largest landowner in the UK behind the Church of England or something at one point.
Makes sense. I mean, I get they're everywhere, obviously. So that's, yeah. What? Tell us a bit more about Hello Lamppost. I mean, first of all, great name, super innovative concept. But yeah, what is it and where did the inspiration come from?
Yeah, where to start? So what it is we're a communication platform, public communication platform. So we activate physical environments and objects within those environments and allow people to have chats with them and interact with them. So, you know, that could be a bus stop or a bench on a street. It could be a statue, a bridge, you know, a building, anything that already exists in the environment. And then people using their own mobile phone can scan a QR code or follow an instruction on that object and have a friendly text-based chat. So how we started, it was never actually originally meant to be kind of a, you know, a platform or a product or a service. It was meant to be a one-off project in Bristol, which went really well. And it was really born out of, I guess, a few observations. So one being that, you know, the physical in our communities, in our towns and cities has existed like forever. And the network in recent history has been added to that. But really, we kind of saw that all of these environments were really single use. So, you know, a bench is used for people to sit on and a lamppost is used to light up the street. But, you know, what if actually there was added layers to that? And, you know, the emergence of the network, you could potentially make that possible, right? So that was kind of one observation. And the other one was that objects that we pass every day not only act as kind of these really hyper local reference points that could potentially be interacted with, but also when we pass those objects or move through areas, we all have like memories, ideas, opinions kind of triggered in our mind, but never leave them or share them with anyone. So that was kind of the few observations that we saw, and we kind of thought, well, you know, originally, what if you could have people interact with those individual objects and leave memories and stories behind and almost create this kind of digital journal mapped across the city? And that was the original kind of concept that was entered into the Playable City Award in Bristol, which we won, and which kind of deployed, you know, the first project in Bristol. And as I say, it was meant to just be this kind of one-off thing. And then over time, you know, cities and organisations around the world were starting to get in touch to ask, well, can we use this to engage our community?
That seems like a, like, if it's called the Playable Cities Award, that seems like that award was custom built for Hello Lamppost. Like, that seems unfair. Like, what?
Yeah, true. Looking back, it was pretty ideal. But those guys are great. The guys at Watershed, you know, they created that to essentially encourage ideas evolving out of the smart city theme, but then we're more people focused.
Talk to us about data. Like, I imagine you get a ton of incredible data out of, you know, this app. So, like, what do you do with it? How does it work? How do you leverage it?
Yeah, cool. So, I mean, how it works. So when someone interacts with an object, you know, they're choosing to interact with that object, and then that chat interaction happens via SMS or WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger. So they don't even ever have to download an app or a login or account. And how it works for them is that object can provide relevant information. It can answer some of their queries, but it will also ask them questions. And that can be anything from, you know, what's your favorite memory of this area, through to, you know, the construction across the road is going to have a tower block. Like, you know, what do you think, or whatever. So it's really aimed to kind of, the platform's aimed to bridge the gap between local decision makers and us as communities and citizens. So yeah, in terms of the data, we obviously do the analytics on all of these anonymized responses, and then provide that back to local authorities, business improvement districts, universities, etc., so that they can make better informed decisions, hopefully. You know, I always like to use the analogy of the iPhone, in the sense that, you know, Apple would never have created the iPhone without listening to prospective end users or existing end users, whereas, you know, our communities, our towns, our high streets, that's really what we've done in history. We've only listened to a very small splice of people, and we want that to be open, right? We want people to understand that, you know, you can easily, as you're walking through a street, provide your opinion, and that will go directly into decisions.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I thought about Hello Lamppost the other day. I've been looking at new apartments in London, and there was this one place really nice over in, I think it was Hackney Wick ish and there was clearly construction happening across the street. And I sort of had this conversation with the landlord, where I was like, what is this going to look like when the construction is finished? And, like, how could I engage with that future version of my apartment or my street, or really right out my window? But I couldn't do it. And I was like, man, this seems like a thing like Hello Lamppost could solve for, you know? So, like,
right, yeah.
Just engaging with, like, so to that point, does it have, like, planning implications, like city planning or urban planning implications? Like, could the data be used for that, to include more of those voices? Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think kind of one of the exciting things for us is, you know, we're just the digital interactive layer. The use case is kind of endless. So, yeah, I mean, we've been used for city planning, so being part of the kind of informal consultation process. So, you know, imagine, like you said, like objects in an area of redevelopment, talking to people, all the way through to more practically, like the actual hoarding at a construction site, talking to someone and telling them what's happening and asking them their opinions. So yeah, we've been used for those types of use cases, and obviously feeding that, you know, that opinion data is really hard to get for people like local authorities, but is extremely useful. You know, at the end of the day, they are public servants. But yeah, I mean, we've been used by other municipalities for, you know, participatory budgeting. So people's opinions going directly into budgets, you know, identifying loneliness from people on a student campus. Yeah, so there's a multitude, all the way through to kind of gathering visitor experience satisfaction at, you know, points of interest.
This seems like a step towards the singularity, like where we all just become one with the machines and our environment.
Right,
things like that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it sounds a bit, you know, blue sky, but I mean, that's ultimately what our vision is about, is making local democracy easier and better. You know, we want to make it easier for people, and we want to make it easier for the decision makers.
Yeah, That's empowering. So getting into that a bit, like what connects you to this personally? Like what's your focus and yeah, how are you connected to the mission here?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, there's no there's no one single event that drove me to start Hello Lamppost or drove us to start Hello Lamppost. It was really a culmination of frustrations and view of how we envisage the future of our cities and towns. So, you know, yeah, like exactly like you said, like frustrations around not being able to understand local information properly, not being able to feed back on certain elements. You know, I still think it's crazy how arduous it is to, you know, communicate with local decision makers and, you know, provide my opinion. I mean, luckily things like COVID have blown town hall meetings out the water, right?
We get them on Zoom and our patron saint, what's her name? Jackie Weaver, right?
Jackie Weaver, Jackie Weaver. So yeah, partly so those frustrations, but also like as a visitor to an area, you know, the lack of ability to understand history of an area, the story of an object or a statue, you know, even people's everyday stories, right? So, you know, obviously responses can be shared anonymously from an object from someone else. So understanding someone's memory from 20 years ago in that location, right? So, yeah, it's kind of that frustration, that kind of, again, that disconnect that exists between us as end users of physical environments and the environments themselves. You know, someone described one use case for Hello Lamppost recently quite nicely, which is kind of bringing the bronze plaque into the 21st century. So
that's a great marketing phrase. Really well done.
Yeah. And then generally on a macro level, I think like a long-standing observation for us is we strongly believe that physical environments are going to become more interactive in general. Things like Pokemon Go blew the door open on that.
Yeah, I have a buddy who like he swears by Pokemon Go and he like meets people. We're travel buddies and we'd drop into new cities and he would just make new friends and like network through Pokemon Go. And I was just
right,
like,
yeah, my mind was blown. It is mind-blowing, people changing their behavior according to when an event happens, right, on Pokemon Go.
That's super interesting. So, like, talking about that, like, how have you seen people benefit from the product? What hidden stories have come up? And like, what decision makers have you seen be influenced by, you know, the work of Hello Lamppost?
Yeah, so, I mean, the couple that, yeah, touched on before, so a city in Canada, you know, the first 6 months of their deployment, they passively engaged their community around the tax budget, this year's tax budget. Actually it's 2020 tax budget. But yeah, they got the highest level of engagement in tax-based engagement, especially when it comes to sub-30 audience. They'd never been able to engage that many sub-30 citizens in the sense of citizens, residents directly shaping their tax budget. So, which seems crazy to me because that's, you know, that's what we should be able to do easily, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I'm trying to get the Tower Hamlets. I mean, don't tell them, but like, I'm trying to pay my council tax and they like, don't make it easy. Like, it's like this whole, right. They send you this like weird email and it's got this attachment that's like 50 years old from like, I don't know if it's a PDF or an HTML or what it is. It's just like, mate, like, give me a link. I'll pay the credit, you know, the card, like what, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that, right? That disconnect that I keep talking about. But yeah, so City of Summerside took Hello Lamppost insights and data among, you know, other mechanisms, and that directly fed their decision around what to spend the city's taxes on. Yeah, you know, another one is we work with a couple of universities, so one in Vancouver, where the platform's used to not only, you know, make the campus experience better and provide people relevant information, but you know, people confiding in objects because they're lonely is kind of a flag for the university, right? Because they need to maintain student well-being. So it's elements like that that always surprise me. And then, you know, other ones that you mentioned are more practically around a city, a municipality, a council is planning certain changes to the area and they want to know what people think.
Seems like you're getting a lot of pickup from Canadians. Is there something particular to Canadians that they just like talking to objects, or what's going on there?
Who knows? I don't know how that's happened. But yeah, we've been pretty fortunate in the various different locations we've deployed, I guess, in terms of global reach. You know, we work with City of San Francisco, Vancouver, UBC, all the way through to kind of Sydney, Singapore. And going back to Sydney, you know, they're constantly now on an ongoing basis using it as a, as they've described, kind of community touch points. So different visitation areas around the Sydney Harbour, they've activated objects. And again, people can understand the history of those points of interest and objects. But actually for the organisation, it's a continuous feedback loop on what people like and dislike and their sentiment. So as they've said, you know, rather than years of kind of stabbing in the dark as to what changes and improvements to make, now it's kind of like, well, here's what people are saying, here's what we should do.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, this product really resonates with me as like a traveler and an immigrant, because I'm just so used to landing in places and being completely lost, completely devoid of any sort of history, you know, and especially here, like being an American and in the UK, like places are hundreds of years old, 900 years old. Right. I'm not used to that. And I would love to be awash in the history and just introduced to it at least, you know? And it's like, yeah. So like, I think just the idea of like getting someone to locate themselves in both in time and space is super powerful. So I love that.
Yeah. Idea. And then you throw in an extra layer, which is, you know, not only are you hearing about the history of a statue, but actually someone else who's been there is sharing their own history and their own memories.
Well, you said you were doing it in Bristol. I mean, that could be a little dangerous, because certain statues, it could be like, well, yeah, that guy is a statue, but he owned this person.
Right. Yeah. Right. But you know, I mean, our counter to that is that's important. We need to know, do people want it there or not? You know, that's who should be deciding, is the community. But yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. Like I always say that the future of Hello Lamppost is imagine you step off a plane, right, in a new area, and you interact with the bench in the airport to find out information. Then you head down to the local museum and you find out the history by chatting to the statue. And then you head to the coffee shop and you chat to the table to order a coffee, right? So it's that interactive layer wherever you go.
So to that point, like you talked a little bit about the future. What is the future of Hello Lamppost? Like, what's the growth plan, and what kind of hurdles do you see ahead there?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere and anywhere. You know, our grand vision really is that anyone in any street can have a chat with any object. You know, that's our ultimate dream. In terms of our kind of, I guess, strategy around that, you know, we want to continue expanding different locations around the world. You know, I mentioned we're working with different locations in Europe, Australia, North America mainly. Yeah, growing that out. So for us at the moment, that is speaking to and being in front of more local authorities, city authorities, universities, etc. Which is, you know, in a challenge in itself when you're still in startup mode. But it's about, you know, getting more demonstrations, so demonstrating more uses by those areas and those cities. And then beyond that, you know, it's touching on other sectors. So healthcare with hospitals and their campuses, it's when they come back, museums and attractions and destinations, all the way through to, like I said, like airports and other transport hubs.
Do you see like a huge opportunity there, like as things are opening back up again, like people wanting to just, you know, engage with their surroundings a bit more and just being more, I don't know, gregarious towards objects? Like, do you see opportunities there?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that everyone's going to be pretty cautious for a while in how they move and use different areas. I mean, it's interesting that you say that. You know, in the UK, there's a big focus now because of the recent announcement around how we reopen the high street safely. So we're now working with a number of local authorities across the UK to help them do that. You know, how do you allow people to have, you know, always available touch points in their community that can provide them, you know, relevant information about COVID guidelines and what the reopening looks like, but also to encourage them, look, it's okay, these shops are open and it's okay to go and explore. I think one observation we did see is throughout COVID is a propensity to explore your hyper-local community. So we saw it in London. You know, I live in West London and, you know, no longer were a lot of people going into Central, but suddenly they were exploring and being concerned with their hyper-local community. So yeah, we definitely feed in that sense.
That's interesting. And then in terms of support with that growth plan and just for Hello Lampos in general, like what would your ask be to the broader community? Like what support are you looking for, if anything?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, look, we're looking to speak to as many city authorities, universities as possible. We know how we can help them. It's just a case of, you know, being able to speak to them and demonstrate what we can do. So, yeah, I mean, any help there. We're always looking for partners in different regions who can help us with that. So, you know, we're setting up a number of partnerships in the UK and Australia around organisations that are already working with those municipalities around those strategies. So any open to any partnerships from that respect. And then, yeah, I mean, to the investor community as well. We're just closing off our sort of pre-seed round, but we'll probably be looking for another round in the next year. So always open to speaking to investors who might be interested as well.
That's great. Wish you luck with that. That's yeah, exciting. Thanks. That's an exciting product. Well, we'll pivot a little bit into sort of our lightning round questions, but you don't need to feel pressed for time or anything.
Wow, okay.
But sort of, yeah, these questions we ask every guest, you know, because they kind of span the tech for good, you know, sector in terms of their focus. The first is pretty pedestrian. What's your tech stack? You know, what do you use in your daily, in your day-to-day, and what's been a game-changing piece of tech for you?
So for us as a system, we have a proprietary in-house system, and then we connect to a bunch of other stuff. So, you know, there's the front end, which is we connect to SMS providers, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, etc. And then we use a bunch of third-party tools as well. In terms of game changers internally, things like Slack and Trello, which a lot of people use, but I find particularly we're a relatively small team still. It's super helpful, especially in these current times where we can't be in front of a whiteboard. And then I guess from a business perspective, like Azure Cognitive Services. Yeah, there are other providers available, but we use Azure Cognitive Services, so that's Microsoft's AI suite of tools and services. So we went through their AI for Good accelerator program. So we got a lot of insight into what's available, how those different applications are being used and why. So we use a lot of their kind of natural language processing and machine learning tools.
And what's the word you're using there for that? What's that program called?
Azure.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. Sorry. That's just me being not from here and not understanding how people say things. Azure. Got it. Yeah. What would you say is one problem that tech can't solve?
I mean, the human aging process is one that we haven't solved. There's a lot of people focusing on it.
Aren't they freezing people though? Like, isn't that happening already?
Yeah. I mean, it's not yet solved. it's something that us as a race is striving for. You know, and we have been striving for a while, but it's something that tech hasn't solved yet. But who knows, we may well get there. I think we will.
Would you want to live forever or extend your life significantly if given the chance?
The short answer is probably yes, but with the caveat that I think the concept of living forever will look very different than how we perceive it now. You know, in the realms of consciousness and mind being separated from body.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like digital, like downloading someone's consciousness or something like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Aren't they saying like the first person to live to like 150 has already been born or something like that? Isn't that the kind of lore that's out there?
Yeah. So in terms of exponential advancements in longevity of age, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's super interesting. I don't know if you've read any of Yuval Noah Harari's books, Sapiens and Homo Deus, would strongly recommend. But yeah, he touches on all of these topics. But yeah, that's one that tech hasn't solved, but it feels like the human race is striving towards.
I saw this really interesting article the other day that was, they studied people who were dying, like in the final moments of death and like brain activity. And what they seemed to find was that it wasn't like a light switch turned off. Like it was like a slow sort of like shutdown of the brain. And by implication, they figure consciousness. So like this idea that like you're moving through a tunnel or like, you know, slowly almost like shutting off and like what that, you know, would do to your consciousness and how you perceive it. And they were just sort of like, yeah, like it suggests that the bridge between this world and the next, quote unquote, is like a, it's a pathway. It's a, you know, step-by-step process, not this like flip, you know? So I don't know. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And it's again, something that, Yuval Noah Harari touches on, but it's that, I quite like the analogy of like, you know, the consciousness that, that we might be able to have, extended or forever is that, that, okay, I feel pain, but why does my consciousness say, oh, I'm feeling pain? There's no use for that thought. So why am I consciously thinking about it? And that's the piece that I think is going to be interesting in the next, you know, 50 or so years that that they look at extending the life of.
Well, sort of flip side of that, or well, similar side of it, I guess, but like tech for bad instead of tech for good. So like what is the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
Yeah, I guess a couple come to mind. So one that I don't think we've seen, excuse me, huge examples of that, but that that potentially poses a bigger risk going forward is kind of remote warfare. So remote hacking, you know, even down to the scale of changing the traffic lights once they're connected to the network, and causing accidents, you know, and you scale that up and you switch off the power to a whole city, right? So that kind of remote warfare, I think, is a huge risk going forward. One that came to mind that maybe is a bit indirect, that wasn't an intentional movement in technology in terms of creating harm, but it is, you know, is the climate, the pollution, you know, a period of rapid evolution in technology led us to kind of where we are now, where we've realized that actually for a number of years we've been damaging the planet. So, you know, indirect, but definitely a retrospectively a tech for bad.
That, I think about that all the time in terms of like the things we're going to have to explain to like our great grandkids and stuff. Like I was saying the other day, like rush hour, we're going to have to explain rush hour, you know, especially like after COVID where people are like now pushed to work from home. And obviously that's not everyone, but like, just like you got in a bunch of like internal combustion engines and you drove, you pushed out gas into the atmosphere and drove for like, you know, 30 minutes or something twice a day. Like, that's absurd, you know, to a job in a building that itself is this massive CO2 producing entity. Like our grandkids are just gonna be like, you're barbarians, and maybe they should.
Yeah. And combine that with the effort that's taken to, you know, pull stuff out the ground in order to do all of those things.
Then you got your lunch from Pret in a plastic thing that's basically oil, you know, like just, yeah, it's when you boil it down. So the actual flip side, if you could, besides Hello Lamppost, dream up a new tech product, what would it be and what problem would it solve, and for whom?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go with probably the easier answer here, just off the back of that, is you know, the tech to, you know, make our society carbon negative. Like immediately with a switch, I think that would be just incredible. You know, it would mean an enormous amount for the human race. So yeah, it's not no specific tech, but it would, you know, it would impact the whole world.
Do you worry about, like, I guess it'd be called moral hazard in that case, like the fact that like we can just run roughshod for as long as we did and then just have this like instant tech fix for it? Like, do you think that is problematic in any way?
Well, you know, I think we're going through that switch now, but it's a slow switch. That argument still exists now. People just saying, I'm just going to carry on for as long as possible because someone will solve it. You know, someone will sort it out. So that argument still stands, I think, whether it's an instant switch or not.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, and that's not to argue for people need to suffer because we made the planet suffer, but just sort of like, I wonder about like what sort of incentives, disincentives that creates for people in terms of like their behavior, but frankly companies mostly, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, it plays out into a whole bunch of different moral dilemmas, right? We've sort of evolved into a time where we deal with non-immediate problems as a society. So, you know, climate action, for example, we're now able to spend the time and the capacity to look at those longer term issues. Whereas, you know, years gone by, we were worried about whether, you know, the next nation was going to invade us or, you know, when the next, you know, pandemic was going to wipe out a whole population. You know, we didn't have the time or mental capacity to think about those larger problems. I think that's a huge benefit to us now, is that yes, there's going to be hurdles, but we're able to think years in advance rather than, you know, a year in advance.
Yeah, that's really well said, because I was thinking about that the other day as I was just processing like the past year, and that, like, you know, our parents and grandparents' generation, like, they legitimately, and this varies obviously according to class and where you're from and all that stuff, but like, they legitimately had to worry about war and, like, you know, diseases for which they did not have vaccines that were invented in less than a year, you know, like, and I was just like going about my day, and I was like, wow, like, my job is to, like, basically just take care of my body and, like, survive this pandemic. Whereas, like, there were so many other threats, I feel like. And then I was like, how did that prevent them from maybe doing certain things that I am now able to do because the context was different? So,
right. Yeah. And look, exactly what you just said, like, your focus now is on preserving your body and your mind. And it goes back to my point, I guess, which is we've gone from a time where, you know, I need to worry about preserving myself and my family for the next month or year, protection from war and famine and plague, to a point where now as a society we've moved into how can we preserve ourselves so much that we live forever.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Yeah. And also I think about the protests last summer, and, you know, there was a moment there where, like, everyone was sat at home and basically getting money from the government to do so. And then I think it allowed their focus to shift to these broader societal issues of justice and fairness. And in a way, it empowered people to be like, wait, I now have time to focus on not just making my next paycheck, but, you know, what's happening to other people that I care about around me who maybe look different than me. You know, like, I thought that was a really powerful moment, like, if nothing else for universal basic income or furlough scheme or whatever. But
yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, what I've sort of observed and sort of been humbled by is when you have a common global problem, how much not only do people pull together, but then, like you said, they start to think about solving problems that also affect other people rather than just self.
Yeah, I think we're getting to a really interesting moment with the vaccine situation, where people are like, look, you can hoard the vaccine and be a vaccine nationalist, but that's going to come back to bite you. And like, but then that's an also interesting moral thing, because it's like, am I doing this because I don't want to get in my country, you know, like, the disease, or because I think it really needs to happen and it's fair? And
yeah, I mean, it goes sort of speaks to something that I always say, that obviously I've never been in space, but I've read, you know, a couple of books of people who have, and I just think that, like, if we could all go up into space and see the world and have what astronauts call the overview effect, where they suddenly immediately stop thinking of themselves as British, American, Canadian, whatever, or even a Londoner, right? And they think themselves as a human. Like, if we could get everyone on the world to think and have the think like that and have the overview effect, then, you know, how much more would we pull together and just think about these arbitrary lines that have been created across landmass?
Just shoot everyone in the space and that'll make it better.
That's easy, right?
We're kind of getting into that space where we're starting to talk about the future and things are opening up and things like that. So specific to the tech for good sector, though, like, what's your prediction for the rest of this year and beyond? What do you see happening?
Well, the rest of this year, I think it will be more of what we've seen in the past year. I think we'll definitely see a permanent shift to more digital nativity, where, you know, people previously who are maybe less comfortable with technology and tools will suddenly have embraced it. I think we're going to see a huge shift in, or an increase in, tech for good organizations, both for-profit and not for-profit. And that movement, I think, will continue for the foreseeable. I think there's two things to that. I think COVID's been an accelerator. I think it was already bubbling away, though. The other driver for, you know, an increased focus in tech for good and you know, tech for good companies as an industry, I think the other influence on that is a larger societal consciousness from younger generations. Like, I think, if certainly just speaking for, like, my generation and you know, my peers compared to Gen Z's, millennials, etc., you know, it's a stark difference in how they see the world in a good way, right? I'm glad, I'm really happy for it. And I've used this example recently, but, you know, Marcus Rashford, the footballer, is, I don't know, early 20s and has obviously rightly stood up on certain issues. Now, if you look back 50 years, you know, a young black footballer, that would never have happened. Never would a footballer have stood up for any sort of political movement. And I think that's a sign of younger generations being more, yeah, societally conscious.
Yeah, more plugged in. I mean, there are examples of sports people who are very political, but you're saying specific to football, right? Like that was just not on the radar for folks.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And particularly, you know, I use him as an example, but the number of them in sports now is far higher. And my point with him really is his age as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I think I was saying this about the protests last year. Like it was a moment where you got to see everyone, whether a sports person, a chef, you know, a techie, flexing the same muscle, you know, and that muscle being like, you know, sort of their stance and involvement in issues of racial justice. And like, that's so rare, you know, and I would say the same about COVID and like public health. Like you kind of got to see like how all your friends are, you know, navigating health crises and how they attend to themselves and public health guidance.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, and I think that whole movement is going to eke out into industry as well. I think companies and corporations are increasingly going to be held to account for their environmental and societal impact, you know, and I think, you know, I think increasingly they are going to be tied to their balance sheet. Yeah, I think that's one shift that we are definitely going to see, and I think it's going to be quicker than we think. And the other movement, you know, which goes hand in hand, is we're already seeing an increase in investment from the investment community in tech for good. And, you know, one organization that we work with, Social Tech Trust, who co-ran the AI for Good program, you know, that's their kind of DNA is encouraging more enterprise which marries, you know, profits and purpose.
Yeah, I agree with that, and partly because it's self-serving and that's who we work with, but you know, I think it's like a good thing for the world, obviously. And yeah, I mean, I think it's just that moment where like things are converging, you know, like it's like impossible to run a business and not take into the negative externalities of your business that affect the environment and things like that. So
yeah, exactly. And I think it's, you know, I think it goes back to our point about an increase in people, no matter what their age, no matter what industry they're in, having that consciousness about societal benefits and environmental benefits. So that's all driving like a perfect storm into, you know, enterprise, which drives our capitalist society at the moment.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to see the cultural meet the technical, meet the, you know, economic, like it's fascinating. Yeah. Well, I mean, last question, and I think it relates to this idea, like part of the pod is constantly refreshing our definition of tech for good and what it means and how it operates and things like that. And we've sort of landed on this idea that one part of it is building a life where you balance profit and purpose, as you said, or, you know, maybe not profit, but just making a nice living for yourself. So how have you done that? Like what's worked well for you, you know, in balancing those two things in your career?
For me, I think it's something that's evolved as I've grown up. I think, you know, I think I always knew I wanted to run an organization or a business of some sort. And I think when I was perhaps younger, I had the Silicon Valley, Hollywood story in my mind. And that's probably now shifted slightly to be, you know, 50-50 with impact and purpose. Probably for a multitude of different reasons. But I guess what's worked for me, and I think, you know, we're going to see more and more of this with the Tech for Good movement, is the motivation landing with the purpose or the user as opposed to just the buck. You know, with Hello Lampo specifically, we were fortunate enough that we didn't start as a, you know, as a product or a paid for service. So consequently, we focused on the value for the user experience and what that end user, that end citizen gets out of it. And it just happened, you know, nicely and coincidentally that actually we were able to provide value on both sides, you know, whilst still maintaining a business. Whereas, you know, a darker path where Hello Lamppost could have gone is just try and become, you know, a data harvesting ads platform on the street, right? Which is what we've always veered away from. So I think, I guess my point being is what's always worked for us is, and I think we're going to see more of it, is focus on the user. So if your motivations are clearly focused on the user of your product, service, business, whatever it is, then you're always going to be able to align profits and purpose. Some ideas may not work out, but you know, maybe they're not to be.
Yeah, that's a really good idea, and that's, I mean, I just think really good advice for like young founders, like ground yourself in the user, which like I think implicitly suggests that you're trying to improve people's lives in some way through whatever your product is. Like, you know, that hopefully you're not going into it with negative intentions, but yeah.
That's yeah, exactly. You know, start with the problem for the user. And, you know, I think what we'll see is more solutions and companies will be focused on the citizen as a user.
Yeah. But I think you're touching on something important too, which is like, I think, and you mentioned Silicon Valley, like that we, I think, are maybe coming out of an age, or maybe you're still in it, where people were using that language of help and sharing and community when like really it was just kind of like a bald-faced capitalist play for like a ton of money and data and things like that. And it's like, how did the sharing economy work out for gig workers who like still, you know, don't have benefits and like how did, you know, so on and so forth. So I think like, yeah, like how do you get to the true core, like actually trying to help people and not just use the language to, you know, pull the wool over people's eyes and make a ton of money. So
right, exactly. I think that's a really key phrase is pulling the wool. You know, I think tech companies as an industry have been able to live through an age of rapid technological advancements and pull the wool over people's eyes and make the money in the background without them knowing. Whereas I think, you know, because of all of this focus around tech for good, social purpose, the investment community all having a focus around being forced to focus on society, I think we'll see that shift towards, you know, what problem are you solving for that citizen, rather than just use them as a mechanism for the buck.
Well, Tiernan, it's been awesome to have you on. It's been a great conversation. We really appreciate your time. We're very excited about Hello Lamppost and its future and what it's going to do for cities and universities and everyone. And yeah, just grateful for your time.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks for having me on. Really nice chat. Sorry if it got too broad, but no, I really love these chats. Yeah, thanks a lot.
And tell our listeners where they can find you. How do they find you in Hello Lamppost?
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on Twitter at Tiernan Minds. You can find Hello Lamppost at Hello Lamppost on Twitter. And our website is www.hlp.city.
Perfect. hlp.city. And we'll throw that in the episode description as well. So super grateful for your time. Really appreciate you and all the work you're doing, and yeah, have a good rest of your week.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for the chat, Paul. You too.
All right, thanks.
Speak soon.
Bye now.